I am Erhard Gerstenberger from Germany and Brazil, as you probably know, and we are talking today and working today on Latin American psalmody, confidence and plea. To give you a more vivid example of Latin American psalmody, I like you to learn a few Portuguese words first, you know, and sing them. I hope I can teach you. If not, perhaps Guilherme will help me. The words are very simple. The only difficult thing is the nasalized consonant, ving, you know, ving, that means come. Ving, come. Ving, senhor, ving libertar o teu povo. So only this, you know. Ving, senhor, ving libertar o teu povo. You almost understand it, you know. Come to liberate your people. Come to liberate your people. That's a refrain of one of the psalms which exist there, which are sung there. Ving, Senhor, ving libertar o teu povo. Sung, it is a little bit drawn together. I'll try to sing it. Ving, Senhor, ving libertar o teu povo. Ving, Senhor, ving libertar o teu povo. Does it sound right to you? Do you know it?
Music is not only for special people, it's for everybody.
Right. Do you know the song by chance,
no.
Guilherme? We try it again, and we will repeat it at the end, so you know some words of a Brazilian hymn, you know, even only these few. Ving, Senhor, ving libertar o teu povo. The words which follow are, in spite of all the hunger, in spite of all the misery, this people is still expecting your coming, you know. That's exactly what we talked about before, that in spite of all these things, communities meet and sing praises and sing laments and sing and break out in joy above all and dare to voice their complaints and laments and their accusations. Well, I want to point out that this call on God to come and help is a very, very old way of addressing God. It's right there in the Old Testament Psalms with many expressions like, quickly, come, help me, answer me, come to my help, come to my rescue, salvage me, and so on. There are innumerous examples of this kind of crying out to God to come for immediate help. And it goes through the New Testament with the expression in the book of Apocalypse at the end, Maranatha, come Jesus, come, come. And it goes on to our days, as you see, you know, come and help us. I don't know whether we in our hymn books have hymns which contain this urgent cry for help. I don't know. Sometimes you are surprised if you make comparisons and try to figure out what language and what images and what formulations are used in the Psalms, and then you try to find them again in the hymn book, in our hymn books, and you are sometimes surprised not to find some things. There's a study, incidentally, by an East German pastor who tried to find out the Exodus motif, you know, this also crying out to God and asking for liberation, for salvation from oppression. And he found in German hymn books, he found no trace of this, almost no trace of this motif of Exodus help, you know, crying people, come and help. Ving, Senhor, ving libertar o teu povo. Incidentally, I may show you this commentary on the Psalms, which I wrote in English, which had come out in the last year here in the United States. It's a more more technical commentary, principally for those who understand the Hebrew behind it. It's not all in Hebrew, I must comfort you, but it's a more technical thing. I will leave this here for give it to the library to so you can consult it. And for the time being, I still use it, you know. Okay. Second, I ask you to participate in this in these sessions with your own contributions. And the result for the time being are three contributions. The manner we should proceed, this item is for me very important, and I'm very encouraged by the examples I got, is I would suggest the following. I will read some of it here, as much as possible, of your contributions. Without identifying persons, I think it's better to leave it all without names. And then we will ask the same thing to do for you. I'll ask you to do another thing for the next session on Friday, and another one another time for Saturday. And then we probably have a collection of Psalms. And I might ask you, some of you, who stay on for a little while after Saturday, I have to leave on Saturday, to do some redactional work on these Psalms and get them into some form so that others may use them here at Holden. You know, write them up. I think that's a good thing to do. So be prepared that I ask for a redactional committee to work while I'm gone. And I hope that somebody will volunteer to take this into his or her hands. I'll simply go and read parts of it, parts of these Psalms which I received until now. And perhaps there are some more in the making. I heard some people say that they wanted to contribute, but probably didn't make it for lack of time. There are so many things to do, I know. Dear God, why must I feel alone amongst so many? I cannot let others' disapproving looks penetrate my being. They do not understand. They cannot understand. One, lament. O Lord, why can't I feel your presence? I feel only the gray skies, the cold mist that seeps into my bones. The bleak buildings of the city loom dark over me, staring with blank window eyes. Why have you left your people clustered in cement and neon? Snarled in electric wires and computer components, choking in smog and asbestos. My friends then don't know you and don't care to. Your son is trivialized by street evangelists who shout at the backs of commuters. I find no place in my calendar to pencil you in. I dream, if I read that right, I dream in meetings and deadlines and quotas and repath or repacks. I'm sorry that I can't read it so well. And strategic plans. I drown in meetings and deadlines. That's better. Yeah, that makes better sense. I drown in meetings and deadlines and quotas and repacks and strategic plans. This one word is a little bit reports, probably. I'll leave it at that because the other part I didn't manage to read yet, but we will decipher it still and get it written down. And the last example. My focus is inward and looking at me. Trouble and sorrow fills up what I see. The picture is blurry. There's too much to do. I need lots of help, Lord, from someone like you. If I burn wood, it brings down acid rain. There's war, injustice, hunger, and pain. They say that my government represents me, but they are doing so much with which I disagree. It pulls at my heartstrings and boggles my mind. Lord, you know the answer. Please give me a sign. Lord, give me an answer, and I'll do my part to rid this confusion and hurt from my heart. Though I'm small as an ant, I'm willing to try. So out of these depths, I am sending my cry. You see the diversities of concerns, the diversity of language, and I think you feel that every single contribution is going to right to the center of things which we are discussing. I don't think we should talk about these examples. We should only hear them and meditate them. I only want to say that nobody should be discouraged to write his or her own psalm, perhaps by such a perfection of language as sometimes perspires here in some of these examples. You know, there's so much refined language already, and even poetry doesn't need to be. The language may be very, very simple, and it need not be rhyme poetry. You know, although it's very gratifying to see that somebody is able to do it, you know, and put it in verse like we do. The Hebrews had no verse, no rhymed poetry. They had other means to express their poetic style, you know, the rhythm and so on. So, and third, I want to give you four points, sum up what we said a little bit, what we said before, and to be able to continue, okay? First, we said that the Psalms in all cultures and in all groups which compose Psalms are expression of a particular faith. I always believe that faith is a very, very concrete, down-to-earth matter, which is very much lined up with our immediate concerns, which is not at all eternal. We are mortal beings, and our faith is mortal, so to speak. And our faith, therefore, the Psalms, as expressions of that faith, have to demonstrate a great variety of forms and contents and concerns, and each variety is in some way linked to the group which is behind this composition, which behind the ritual which is being performed, which behind the service, the worship, the incantation or whatever is behind the psalm or surrounding the psalm. So please keep this in mind. We are dealing with three points really all the time. With Old Testament psalms in their setting of old, Hebrew society of varying shades and varying structures, nomadic and tribal and family and monarchic and diaspora society of the Jews, you know, there are various backgrounds to the Hebrew psalms already. And then we are in a second or in the first instance, we are leading with Brazilian and Latin American psalms of today's backgrounds, also of different shades and varieties, certainly. And thirdly, that's our aim, to get at our situation as they situations transpire already in these three examples. And I think you did a very good, or the three who wrote did a very fine job in getting to formulate some of our concerns, you know, of our laments. That was our first assignment, your first assignment. So that was the first point. Keep in mind the differences of groups and situations behind each psalm. Second, the Old Testament psalms and every other psalms are always living on a longer tradition. They are not so much yet. Well, this is a fact which is given because we are reading a book which was composed over centuries, you know, the Bible, the Old Testament, the Hebrew Scriptures. It took centuries to compose this. And in the Old Testament case, we see more than the Brazilian case that these psalms, these texts, these laments or prayers have transcurred or have been transmitted through various stages. So they have been polished like the pebbles which we see in the river. They have been polished by tradition. In the Old Testament Psalms, you find very little references to personal and geographic names, for instance, to individual historical moments. They are all already polished over to become more generalized expressions of faith because they have been used by so many people. I think it's basically wrong to interpret Psalms as the expression of only one person speaking. You have always to see generations of persons using these texts in worship. And this becomes true also for the Brazilian Psalms. They are more recent. You find more references to individuals, to names, like in your Mass also, you know. I read the texts again, and you find names like Jose and even personal names, and you find places mentioned. This is good and fine, and this will probably also be in the first stage behind our efforts to compose psalms. We need to refer to special incidents, which we know. But as the time goes on, and if your psalms then enter into the Holden tradition, they get polished over and over and used over and over, and then after a while, these names disappear because they mean so much anymore.
That's right that you are telling, because after 10 years, for example, the first song of the Mass, Vamos Todos al Banquete, I have special names from neighborhoods. But after 10 years, I have seen how these names have been disappeared. Because the another people from another countries are using this song, and they put away these names.
Exactly, that's what I mean.
They use only the general parts of the words.
Thank you very much, Guillermo. That's exactly what I mean. So you can nicely compare Old Testament psalms on this point with Brazilian songs and prayers. And they are more, they are fresher still, you know, more concrete in there. But this does not matter. We have to see these different stages. And thirdly, we noticed that the laments we considered last time use in the Old Testament and the Brazilian scenery, they use very, very stark language, depicting the needs of the day of that group. In the case of the Brazilian Psalms, you find a great variety of laments, naming everything which is oppressive and distasteful and brutal and things like that, in a language which is the daily language. It's not a sacred language which is used. It's a daily language. Lord, we are earning a misery of a wage, so for instance. These our oppressors are behind us like, they consider us like starved dogs, you heard. Or we are considered the miserable of the earth, and so on. And they tell you how children starve, and they tell you how women are disrespected, and they tell you how the doubt is growing in one's own heart. Is there a God who can see all this? And so on. The language is very daily, very direct, and very stark. I want to tell you an example of my parish work. I tried to use such language in my parish in Essen, and I remember very distinctly an instance when I read a prayer which I had composed, which ran something like, Lord, help me to forgive my resentful or my hateful neighbor, or the neighbor who hates me. And a woman got up and walked out of the church. He said, this is no language you can use in a church, in a worship service. You see, that's exactly the point. There may be people who are offended by such a language. You know, by this directness and by this kind of daily involvement. They think that the worship service as a whole and the liturgy in particular has to be on a much higher level than our daily affairs. No, I don't think so. That's also what we learned from your masses, which you played and sang, and you got examples for that. And fourth, is this also the last point of my summary. The laments already, I said, are based not on lamenting alone. The motive of a psalm cannot be the lament in itself. It's not possible. You have to come from another experience of being liberated, of being accepted, of being recognized as a human being. And this is very important. The joy of liberation is behind Brazilian psalms. The joy of being saved is behind Old Testament psalms. You see, we will talk about this on Friday in particular, but I wanted already to mention it in order not to forget it, to make you aware of this fact, the joy of being liberated. This does not exclude, I would say, the that person who feels downtrodden, forgotten, and full of doubt. I can sympathize in particular with this first contribution which I read. Dear God, you know, why must I feel alone amongst so many? This can be, I don't think that mysteriously that this kind of feeling cut off, feeling neglected, feeling alone, would impede a psalm. I know so many psalms, and the prime example is Psalm 88, if you want to only to remember that. Psalm 88 almost shows no sign of hope. It is almost a psalm which is talking only in these molds of being neglected. Why hast thou forsaken me, you know? I don't mean that. I don't mean to exclude. I want to invite those who feel that way and who are not seeing God anymore. You know, as a minister, as a pastor in my congregation, I love to talk to atheists. I love to. And in some other occasion, I said my father was an atheist and I became a pastor. And I think that goes well together. He left the Roman Catholic Church because he... my grandfather too, and my father also, they left the Roman Catholic Church because they felt neglected, pushed away as workers, as simple workers. My father was a miner, and my grandfather was a carpenter working in a mine in Silesia. And they felt utterly disrespected by that church, and they left it and said, well, this church we cannot be members of. And they became atheists. confess atheism. And I always love to talk to atheists in my congregation because they have so much more concern about God in the world. That's really true. My uncle, who my father died very early in 48 already, but my uncle, brother of my father, he lived until 75, and he was of the same kind, of the same wood, you know. And he involved me in so many discussions, you know. He always said, you study theology, what is that about? Do you believe in God? There is no God, because the church is so wretched, you know. And so we argued and argued. And I really took a liking to all the atheists which I could find. In my congregation, I found many in my visits. So I think the feeling of being excluded, of being forgotten, like we read in Psalm 22, why hast thou forsaken me, forgotten me, that's a very authentic feeling of those people who write Psalms. And I think when I say that the liberation experience, the feeling of being accepted is behind, I would rather attribute this to the community where somebody is part of, you see, not to the individual. I would say this experience lives hard and strongly in the community. We are accepted, we are. And I will give you more examples for that a little bit later. So these were my four points of summary. And I think they also serve to a little bit already to get ahead. Now we want to get into confidence and plea. I have to shorten always. I write too much here into my book, and then I cannot manage to give it all to you in a short time of 1 hour. So I have to shorten a little and get you to talk also. You see, a psalm cannot simply be composed out of lament, I think. That's a basic communal vision of the psalm. But it has more elements to it. And the elements which we are talking today are confidence and plea. What does that mean? Well, I'll tell you a little bit about my scholarly work, and you don't need to be afraid not to understand it. I will tell it to you without using Hebrew expressions and things like that. I had to write a second dissertation to be able to teach at a German university, and I chose as a subject the Psalms. This is a preparatory to this volume of commentary on the Psalms. Well, my reasoning when I chose this subject was, the Psalms in themselves as a whole are more or less prayers of petition, at least the individual Psalms of lament, where this lament element is very strong. They drive towards petition, come, Señor, ven, Señor, ven, Señor, help me, you know. Hoshieni, that's a Hebrew expression, which you know from Hoshiana. That's the same word. Hoshieni, help me, Lord. Answer me, and so on. So that's the final point, so to speak, in the literary structure of a psalm is the petition. Whether it's spoken or unspoken, it doesn't matter. It drives to the point, save me, tear me out of this misery. So if that is true, I reasoned in this dissertation, then I suppose that the people who used the formula of petition, they in some way used the formulas which are customarily used among people to go and ask for something. You see, the structure of this petition towards God must have some resemblance, I argued, with the normal structure of doing petition, of asking for something in our normal lives, in everyday life. Why? Because we have no other experience of how to ask something than that which we do actually. That's a very interesting theological point, you know, I think. I think that our theological concepts and our theological language always have some relation with our normal life situations and with the customs and patterns we are living in. And so what I ask myself, well, how did people in the ancient times ask, utter some kind of petition? And the first thing I met, or which I found also in the literature already, was you have to introduce yourself, you have to ask for the audience of the one whom you are approaching to give you something, to help you. You cannot simply say, I want bread, you know, I'm hungry, I want bread. Nobody does it. Or give me something to dress, or help me in my hopeless situation. You don't do that. You have to address the person in a more or less polite form, and so you get all the psalms, almost all the psalms, with some kind of invocation: Lord, hear me, help me. Why are you there? And so on. That's almost naturally the form how it starts. And this form to address God, which we call in our scholarship invocation of a psalm, the first part of the psalm, is normally an invocation. Yeah? Just like we deal with ourselves, Jim or Jack or somebody, do you have a minute for me? I want to ask you something, or I want to ask you for something, or Dad, can you give me something? The children learn it from us, you know. You have to add as a person, you have to introduce yourself, and you have to explain why you are there asking for something. Something like this happens also in the Psalms. But this is not our concern at the moment. The next point is already the way of going towards a person and the way approaching God has already is based on some kind of relationship. You hardly will go to anybody totally unknown and ask for something. I guess this is even true in the United States, where people are more open to go, open for each other than in Germany. And it's even true for Brazil, where the people are still more open than you are to go to approach somebody and tell them what they need. When there's a person totally unknown, you hesitate to go and ask. So that means there must be some groundwork, some ground of confidence, of mutual relationship, of understanding before you. And this also applies to God. You know, there must be some common ground between you and God before you go and ask him. Well, this common ground naturally comes from your parents and your group and so on, which taught you about God, to ask and to pray. Certainly that. And in my investigation of these things, I went back to the ancient Hebrews and further than that, and I thought, my goodness, where does it come from that the Psalms, which talk about human sickness and persecution and of individual complaints and so on, they have such a strong personal ground, personal relationship to its God. And then it dawned on me, I think that is something which probably, maybe I have discovered, no, I don't know, perhaps somebody else said it before, but it's at least my favorite idea, you know. I thought, my goodness, these psalms come really from a family background or an original intimate background, because they employ such a language of mutual relation. I will give you some examples immediately, you know. That means that the psalms of individual distress, of individual complaint, really have roots very, very far back, even beyond Israelite history, and then naturally in the early history of Israel, when there were only small bands, where there was no nation. Abraham and his household, they prayed to God, and they were, he had apparently a very great household, you know. In Genesis 14 they say that he mustered 318, I believe, men who could carry the arms to persecute his enemies. Boy, that was a large family, you know. 318 arm-carrying males he mustered. Well, how, imagine the number of children, of women, of old people who couldn't, that must have gone into the thousands. And I was thinking of Ivy, who so told, who told us the other night that she was the oldest of 18 brothers and sisters because her father has three wives. Oh, well, Abraham had a lot of wives in probably they possibly are not all mentioned in the Bible, but he had several. And well, he had only one son, but Isaac. But somehow he had a great household. You know, I don't know. One legitimate son, you know, who was his heir. Well, anyway, we have to go back to these small groups and household groups to find out about the original faith of Israel. And I think this household group kept its influence all through the history of Israel, even when, in later times, when tribal structures and tribal cults and worships and theologies and monarchic state affairs took over. This is my favorite idea, I tell you. You may read others who are a little bit different, so I will give you my opinion. If you read Walter Brueggemann, his books are in the library here, in the library, yes, is it? In the bookstore. This is a Portuguese word, livraria. So I'm sorry, sometimes I mix them up. Library is something else here, and they say livraria for the bookstore. Okay, if you read this, he has two books on the Psalms there, and you may find more emphasis. He also accepts, to a certain extent, my ideas, and we were in communication with each other. But he more people accept the idea that the covenant idea is behind most of Psalms. You know it perhaps better, this idea. The covenant, God makes a covenant with all of Israel. And I maintain in the Psalms you feel a strong, strong current of family traditions, of small group traditions, of small group faith, of Abraham's faith. Let's say that. Let's say it this way. There's a difference to it, I guess. The tribal outlook is different, and the national outlook is different from the small group outlook. That's what I want to say. Well, now the examples, I think I will skip a little bit. I will give you some examples, some living examples, first of the Bible and then of Brazilian, of the Brazilian, and then we are open to converse. I'll tell you, I'll give you three instances of these expressions of confidence as they occur in Psalms of Lamentation. And of course I will cut out or not mention, because you all know it, this beautiful psalm, which is all a psalm of confidence: the Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want. You know, that's in itself a whole psalm of confidence, of confidence, of relationship with God. Although, if I analyze the language, I already see the influence of state and king. The shepherd image in the ancient Near East is a royal image. If somebody says, "The Lord is my shepherd," he thinks of a mighty king, not of a humble shepherd. That's an error to think that he's referring to a meek boy who is like the Swaziland boys, you know, a teenager who is herding sheep. No, it's a royal image. Shepherd is the title for a king. That gives it quite a different outlook on the psalm, you know. The Lord is my shepherd. He's a mighty king, you could say. You know, well, I don't want to go into that. I want to give you three examples of this language, and then two more. Psalm 42, verse 5, I quote, "Why are you cast down, O my soul, and why are you disquieted within me? Hope in God, for I shall again praise him, my help and my God." These ultimate words are important. My help and my God. There are studies in our libraries, in our theological libraries, alone about this one word, my God. How does it come about? What does it signify? One word, my God. Eli in Hebrew. Eli. Eli, lama, azaftani. This occurs also in Psalm 22, in the midst of this forsakenness. My God, why hast thou forsaken me? So this is one example, my help and my God. And 62, verse 1 and verse 5 to 7. 62, for God alone my soul waits in silence, from him comes my salvation. And 5 to 7, for God alone my soul waits in silence, for my hope is from him. He only is my rock and my salvation. Images of trust, of confidence. My fortress, I shall not be shaken. And God rests my deliverance, on God rests my deliverance and my honor. And one more example, one more of the familiar small group context, 131 verse 2, 131 verse 2. If anybody has it already, he may or she may read it.
But I have calmed and quieted my soul, like a child quieted at its mother's breast, like a child that is quieted is my soul.
Isn't that a beautiful image? And here it comes to the fore, you know, this family background, a child within on the lap and at the breast of the mother. Beautiful. And I bought a book in the bookstore of my old colleague at Yale, Sally McFaig. She's teaching systematics, Images of God, I think, or...
At Vanderbilt now.
Yes, I know her. I met her there. The title is Image, and she pursues these images of God, of the motherly God, in through the Bible. That's beautiful. I love this. I love this this new kind of looking at the Bible. And this lines up exactly and beautifully with my idea that many of these images of God and the most important theological statements come of family backgrounds and of family, out of family contexts. And here you have one very beautiful. And the image of father and mother, as it occurs throughout the Bible, of God, is of course in the same vein. So, and two more things. Of course, this is not all to it. The affirmations of confidence in the Hebrew psalmody are not limited to these expressions which I quoted. They are much wider. We cannot follow them up here. But I want to point out that in Psalm 22, which we mentioned the other day, that already other aspects of confidence occur. National, tribal aspects, and they run and read like this. I'll quote you this example just to remind you that there are other influences as well, not only family images. Psalm 22, 3 to 5. Yet thou art holy, enthroned on the praises of Israel. Mentioning of Israel. God, you are holy, enthroned. It's a language which we don't understand so easily. Enthroned, as if the praises sung by the people are a throne. You sit upon them. You sit on praises. Your chair, your throne is surrounded by praises. Perhaps this imagery is behind it. You are sitting on praises. Can you sit on them? God can. God can sit on our praise. Imagine what that means for us. You have to praise him in order that he may be able to sit. You know, to take a seat. And sitting is always a majestic gesture. Standing is the servant stands and the majestic people sits. So we are all majesty now, sitting here, you know. And the attendants are standing in the Orient. You have to know that. The situations and times are different, you know. Sometimes it occurs, you know, if a waitress and, you know, people serving at the table are standing, you know, and we are sitting. Well, you are sit enthroned on Israel. You could develop a theology of the praise of Israel, and some people did, like Gerhard von Rad, my country's eminent theologian in the Old Testament, dead now, but he wrote an article on how the praises sung are so important to God, the praises sung by the community, that God cannot be without them. You cannot stop to praise him in order not to make him collapse if you use very strong language. He needs your praise. This may be reflected in here. But it goes on. Where was I? Oh, here. In thee our fathers trusted. They trusted and you didst deliver them. To thee they cried and were saved. In thee they trusted and were not disappointed. Okay? Here you have something of the father tradition, God of the fathers, God of the tribes. He has shown so many times that he is ready to help, that he is listening to the cries of his people, like in Egypt, so that he will certainly help in the new case of misery, of oppression, and so on. They draw on the common history of their people in this psalm. And the another aspect to it is 9 in the same psalm, 9 to 12. I told you already last time that the psalm is mixing laments and affirmations of confidence in a strange mixture. We have, in our orderly way, we say we have to first to lament and then say, well, we are confident that you will help. No, they mix everything. They mix praise and confidence and lament, and then they, in a liturgical fashion, which is not our orderly way and logical way of thinking. 9 to 12 says the following: Yet thou art he who took me from the womb. Thou didst keep me safe upon my mother's breasts. Upon thee was I cast from my birth, and since my mother bore me, thou hast been my God. Be not far from me, for trouble is near, and there is none to help. You know, here again the family imagery. You know, side by side, the traditions of the people and the family tradition. You raised me, you made me to be born, you sheltered me with my mother. Now we have to look at the Brazilian situation. Of course there are differences in expressing confidence and trust in God in the Brazilian situation. The situations are different. And the family situation as a whole has passed by because there are not only families, in individual families worshipping in Brazil. There are base communities, congregations which are worshipping. So it comes to the fore strongly that the hope and the trust which is expressed is a communal affair. And so we find so many expressions that I cannot enumerate them, which say, you are the God of the poor. You heard it already, this expression. You are the God of the poor. And I'll give you just one more. Where do I have my... Oh, here. Example, or two more examples for this, and then I will already, unfortunately, end my sermon, my little sermon. You are the God of the poor. You are simple... This is from your Mass, which you sang. I translated a little bit awkwardly, you know, into English. But it's taken from your... I have the Spanish text here, and Guillermo could read it, and it's more elaborate than that. You know, I took only a few things.
It's from the Nicaraguan
Mass. From the Nicaraguan Mass, yes. You are the God of the poor. You are simple and human. You are sweating on the road. Imagine this language addressing God. You are sweating on the road. You are the God with the sunburned face. Therefore I talk to you just like my people used to talk. You are the laboring God. You are Christ the worker. And I read in the Spanish part, which I hadn't at that time, in full length, you are like a lottery, like a person who sells these derelict persons you find also in New York and everywhere. You are like a lottery seller, you know, who sells how do you say, lottery tickets, you know. Just imagine, what a comparison. You are like a lottery. You are the one at the street corner who tries to make his living like this person. You are God. You are like this one. And so on. You are like a prostitute. You are like the most derelict person I know. You are God. That means you are on our side. This establishes contact with this God. This makes the trust foundation for these people in Latin America. They rely on all these affirmations of the Bible, which say that God really has a predilection for poor people. You heard it yesterday in the service, this prayer of Helder Camara. And I'm a little disturbed on this point, because there are problems to it. We will talk a bit explicitly on Saturday morning, enemies and friends. How do these people now distinguish between God is on our side? You know, there's a big problem. I will talk a little bit more after the second example about this problem. How is it possible to say you are God of the poor? That means you are on our side, and there's another side to it where you are not, people whom you are not with, or not as much with as with us. I'll come back to that point. Let me give you just briefly the second example. Where is it? Here. No, I can save this example to close. And so address me briefly to the problem. You know, when my theory holds tight that psalms grow on a community base and are responsive and important, or are reflective of, they reflect the community which prays the psalm, then they are necessarily bound to be limited in their vision to this group. Although the group may try to look beyond its own limits, that's true. But they are limited. And the way this limitation can become very, very dangerous and very, very disastrous for our faith is when you take this limitation to mean that our group is the only and dominant one. Like we had it in Germany when I was a boy, I inherited from my father, I believe, a military belt buckle. And there was engraved the slogan, God with us. And when I take into my hands your dollar bills, then I see everywhere, in God we trust. And now I ask you, what kind of community does this we trust constitute, you know? It excludes a lot of people who have no dollars, you know. It makes a community. This in God we trust makes a community out of us, of those who can earn or use or buy dollars. And in my German example, we had this buckle, and it made a community of those God with us, that the German emperor designed this phrase, and he was a Protestant, you know, the emperor of the Protestant church also. And the British may have a similar thing, God save the Queen and so on, and my home, my castle. But I don't think they are so outrageous to say in God we trust, or God with us only, you know. You see, there's a danger. If my question is, what is the community like which is being constituted by psalm singing in Brazil? It's the base communities, and I think they know this danger, and they say, we are the community of God. Yes, we experience his help, but we do not exclude the others, even not the rich ones. They have to be converted too. They eventually are also members of the people of God, eventually. But we have to be conscious. I always get into a little dialogue of this kind with my Brazilian friends. Are you aware of this problem? They say we have to point out that God is part. How do you say? Party takes part.
Collaborates.
No, he is part. He takes the party off. He's partition. Partial. God is partial. You know, we have to acknowledge it. God is, if we talk to him like this, we make him partial, and we are partial, we certainly are partial, but we have to establish a community beyond our own. We have to see world community. In Christ, we have see world community, and this is also present in the Psalms and in the Scripture and in Brazilian Psalmody. So now I come to the last example because time is running really fast. Bishop Helder, the other bishop, Pedro Casaldáliga, a good friend of ours and a bishop in the Mato Grosso, whom I mentioned before, who's I was really glad yesterday when I found his diary translated in the bookstore here. I believe in justice and in, what's the title? I believe in justice and hope. Yes. Creio na justiça e esperança. That's it. Justiça e esperança. He wrote a little psalm once. He told me personally how he did it. He was a small man of stature with little physical strength, but great poet and a great spiritual strength. And he was working one day with his peasants in his diocese to clear a little wood to make a plantation. And he got sort of tired of the heavy work. And his peasants' brothers said, "Bishop, go and cook us some coffee. You are tired, you know." And while he was doing the work for the group for the mutirang, they call it, come and work, a song occurred to him. You know, he was a poet, and a song came to him. This song, I never knew that it was of his hand. It's anonymous in Brazil. It runs, it's included in many collections of songs. It's anonymous, but I know from him personally that he composed it, and he made the poem. We are a people of human beings, and this leads us immediately to our second step, which I ignored a little bit so far, the part of the plea, you know, out of confidence, of trust, grows the courage to ask something. He said, "We are a people of human beings. God's people are we." Here is the foundation of trust. We are God's people. And another Brazilian teacher says, Paulo Freire, he says, you have to awaken the people to the consciousness that they are belonging to God. They are so, we said it last time already, they are so dehumanized, so they have so little faith in themselves, they cannot think of themselves as an I, as a person, so they have to give them back their human dignity and their human personality before they can even say something. That he says as a bishop and speaking for the poor, we are a people of human beings, God's people are we, you know, firmly trusting these promises of God, we are. Pronto, they would say, pronto, basta. There's nothing to debate on this. We are. We are not to become, we are. And then he says, what we want is land on earth. Land in heaven, we have got already. Isn't that fabulous? We want something from you people on earth, but also from God. We have a plea, we have a petition, we want something, we need something. What we want is land on earth. Land in heaven we have got already. That means a promise in heaven, you know, that we, after we die, we get there. That's certain for us. Yeah, Luther would have said, would have thrown up his hands, you know, and said, well, that's not possible, you cannot talk this way. Depends on circumstances, my brothers and sisters and brothers. I would say that a German citizen of the 16th century, well established in his crafts and his income and his securities, he cannot say, "I know that I'm going to heaven after death." You know, that's not possible. And Luther was right to denounce this kind of false security. We bought some absolution from the church and we go to heaven. Well, pronto, we have the money to pay our way to heaven, you know. This is not said. the poor have some promise to go to heaven, you know, because they are liked and loved by God. The poor, the derelict, the wretched ones, the dispossessed, the disprivileged, they have something to rely on, and not the ones who are secure in there. So you have to consider the context of what you say. This Casaldáliga's word is very true in his context, and Luther's was in his. So I have to stop. I have to stop. I'm sorry that I give you so little opportunity to talk. And now it's your turn. I wanted to point out, you know, confidence, basis of trust, plea, parts of Psalms of Lamentation in the Old Testament and in a different way in Brazil. That's it. So your comments or whatever you have.
Were you able to convert these atheists in Germany?
No. Oh well, you see, I think it's a serious question, but I think, could we put it the other way? You, or at least ask the other question at the same time, were the atheists able to convert me? In a certain way, you know, to be aware of their needs, of their loneliness, of their forsakenness by the church, you know, this in this respect, you know. I think we have to talk, I'm a theologian, but I prefer to talk about human things and not about lofty theological things. Are you?
Just to throw on something, Father John Sobrino, a Spanish theologian in El Salvador, said about atheism, that is very simple and very beautiful. He said, atheism is not necessarily a sin. Idolatry is always a sin.
Oh, very good. Very good. Thank you, Bill. Yeah.
As I think about the idea of plea, I would have to confess that it's very difficult for me to pray for myself.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, give me something. I wonder if this is a common point of view. I mean, the petition is what I hear more when there's an opportunity for prayer. We ask for God to intervene on behalf of others, or perhaps for God to give us the strength to deal with circumstances. But very rarely do modern people, it seems to me, ask for, say, healing, or for riches, or for, you know, particular. I don't know if that's just in my context or if that's something that other people have seen.
I find that true, except in desperate circumstances.
Yeah.
Then it's very easy to say, oh God, I need this healing right now.
Mm-hmm.
There's a vulnerability that I need in order to be that humble before God.
Mm-hmm.
And usually I don't have it because it's too troubling.
I think that that's one of the ways, and this may sound peculiar, but I believe that the power of evil in Satan is real, and I think where he renders us ineffective is in that very, very place. As long as we keep our eyes on other things all the time, we never look at our own need for growth and our own need for depth and closeness in our walks with God. And the reverse is true also. We can focus so much on ourselves, we forget the world exists. But there's a lot of ineffectiveness sometimes in it.
Yes. Are there more comments, please, or doubts, or questions?
When we talked yesterday, we talked a little bit afterwards about the fact that in our home parish, the people who so often, when we have our time for sharing and requests for prayer, the people who most often verbalize the basic needs.